I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur Jack Dorsey. He's the co-founder of Twitter, a social networking media service launched in 2006. Twitter has over 500 million users internationally. The company gained global recognition when it facilitated the Iranian protests of the presidential election in 2009. Jack is also the co-founder of Square, a mobile payments company that allows any merchant to accept payments through a device that plugs into their smartphone's headphone jack. The company started by working with micro-merchants or small business owners who didn't traditionally have the ability to accept credit cards, but it has grown rapidly to include other services and larger businesses, such as Starbucks, as well. Jack is a former massage therapist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with your personal life because I think it helps to inform the choices that you've made later on. You grew up in Missouri, in St. Louis, and you had a particularly close relationship with your parents, especially your mother. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, my parents have a very interesting story. My father, when he was 19 years old, started a pizza restaurant with his best friend, and they called it Two Nice Guys. The business started doing very, very well, and they needed to hire help, and they wanted to preserve their friendship and also the business. So they made one rule between the two best friends, which is they would not date the waitstaff. And the first person they hired was my mother. My father fell in love with my mother and went to his best friend and said, "I broke the rule. The business is yours." And I was born 10 months later. Hmm. So my parents have always had this edge of entrepreneurship. My mom later started a coffee store in St. Louis called Shenandoah Coffee. Mm-hmm. And my father has had a small business around medical devices for over 25 years. Mm-hmm. So I've learned a lot about starting small and starting one's own business from them.
Obviously, you observe them being very entrepreneurial. But what about emotionally? How was your relationship with them?
It was great. You know, they always pushed me to explore new things. And I had a very meandering, wandering path throughout my life. And that was always something that was loved and accepted. I think technology, especially Twitter, has really deepened our relationship.
Why is that?
Because when we first started Twitter, we got a lot of critique about it being used to talk about what one is having for breakfast, for instance. You know, to 99.9999% of the world, updates like that are useless. But my mother loves it. She loves knowing that I'm eating breakfast every day, and she loves knowing that I'm alive. And it's these little things in life, these small details, that really bind us. We always know what's going on in each other's lives.
It's ironic that you say Twitter's brought you closer because you focus on the mundane aspects of your day, because that's exactly what Twitter has been criticized for. Like, who cares about that? And it's actually just that which has been the most important in your usage of it, vis-a-vis your mom, at least.
I believe so. And also for public figures that we often put on pedestals. You know, one of the most compelling moments for me was watching on the campaign trail in 2008. President Barack Obama talking about what he had for breakfast or just little details of his day. And I think that adds so much context. It rehumanizes people.
Technology was an important part of your life, you know, even when you were 7, 8, 9 years old, and you had a particular interest in maps. Why were you drawn to maps so much, and how did technology tie in?
My parents always loved the city. I just loved the energy. I loved the dynamic range, how electric it felt. So in order to understand the city better, I developed this fascination with maps, maps of New York, maps of St. Louis. My parents bought a computer in 1984, Macintosh, when I was 8 years old, and I just fell in love with that technology as well, because you could see things move around, and it wasn't just a static map, but I could actually start programming them, and I could teach myself, and I did teach myself how to draw maps on the computer, and then to draw dots moving around the map, and then constrain them within streets, and then I had all these dots moving around this map, and I thought it was the most beautiful thing in the world, but the dots had no meaning whatsoever. So my parents had a police scanner. They had a CB radio. We lived right next to the highway, so I heard all this activity. And if you listen to an ambulance or a police car or a fire truck, they're always reporting where they are, what they're doing, and where they're going. So, and I could use that as input for my programs that I was writing to attribute meaning to one of those dots. And I could actually simulate its path throughout the city, which was amazing because suddenly I could see the city living and breathing, and I added more and more dimensions, taxis, black cars, couriers, and I eventually learned that this entire practice had a name and an industry, which was called dispatch. Mm. So I made it my life to go after and write dispatch software and find the biggest dispatch firm in the world, which happened to be here in New York City.
You were engrossed in programming from an early age. What were you like socially at school? What was your reputation?
I was more quiet than not. I went to all Catholic school for most of my life until university. I really loved drawing.
While you seem to have had a very nurturing, loving home environment, you had dreadlocks, you had blue hair, you listened to punk rock, you had this nose ring, you have a big tattoo on your forearm. Do you have any other tattoos?
I have a tattoo of a star on my ankle.
You have one on your ankle.
Yep.
Now, is this just emblematic of, you know, the typical turmoil of adolescence, or was there more going on?
Well, I like experimenting a lot, and I'm somewhat impulsive. So when I decide to do something, I pretty much go all in. So I had dreadlocks when I first moved to San Francisco, I listened to a lot of punk rock just because I liked the attitude. There was an attitude in punk rock which really mirrored hacker culture, which was you don't have to be perfect at performing, you don't have to be perfect at an instrument. You take a guitar and you get out there.
And it seems like that's what you've done with Square in a way. You had no background in financial services, but you said, you know what, let's just take my guitar and get out there.
Yeah, yeah. You drive more by principle of what you want to see in the world. Mm. And you do whatever it takes to make sure that happens.
Incidentally, you refused to learn how to drive as well.
Yeah, I was a big fan of public transit because I thought it was core to cities.
The style that you carried, the dreadlocks and the nose ring, et cetera, are particularly striking given the way you look today, short hair, very clean shaven, sort of, actually, not really,
yeah.
And just very dapper. So you seem to have jumped into now this new style.
Well, I mean, we raised our first round at Twitter with a tattoo and a nose ring. It doesn't change people's perception of you that much. It was really about the merit of video, and that's what I loved about it.
You now run and meditate and eat well. Have you always been mindful of your health and fitness?
When I was a kid, I developed this fascination with walking through my Aunt Eileen. She would walk all the time, and that was really my first form, although I didn't know what I was doing, of meditation, because that's where I really go to when I want to think about something or think through something or just get away. I take a walk.
Did you run today?
No, I did exercise. I do exercise every day.
What did you do?
Just simple stuff, jumping jacks, jump rope, sit-ups, and push-ups.
In your hotel room?
In my hotel room.
And you think you're alone. You're like, I'm the only one doing this. But actually...
No, I know I'm not alone.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, co-founder of the social networking company Twitter and Square, the mobile payments company. Jack eats two hard-boiled eggs with soy sauce every morning. You left University of Missouri during college and moved to New York City. And this is after you hacked the system of a public company called DMS, Dispatch Management Service. And the CEO was impressed and said, come to New York. Mm-hmm. So you transferred to NYU and you ended up working for this company. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was great. So I always wanted to work in dispatch. I always wanted to live in Manhattan. And I found the biggest dispatch firm in the world, which was DMS. I found that they had this hole in their web server, and I emailed them, here's how you fix it. And I was flown out, and within a week I had a job. And we decided to move to San Francisco. in 1999 and start a more web-focused dispatch company.
In addition, you also started together with Greg Kidd, the founder of the company, an e-commerce software company that offered same-day deliveries. And it struck me that this was very early days and really the nascent stages of e-commerce. And the company was called DNet, and it ultimately didn't work out. Do you think it was just timing?
I think it was timing. It was also we didn't really put the emphasis on engineering. We had very, very few engineers and a lot of salespeople, and it was just out of balance. Also, we built the company at the same time the entire bubble was about to burst. I learned a lot from that experience. That was the first company that I really pushed and built. I was a founder, but I wasn't running any of the company, and that's one of the things that I took away from it.
During this time, you know, moved to San Francisco, your first startup did not go well. You had random programming jobs. You built a dispatching service for the ferry service going to Alcatraz, among other systems. You became a massage therapist. You took sewing classes. This is all in the spirit of exploration. But was there any jitteriness of feeling like, okay, my motor's really turning, but I'm really not making palpable linear progress?
No, I never saw it that way. You know, programming is an art and a craft that you stay in your head a lot. You're not really working with your hands. Your hands are on the keyboard, but it's all mental. Every time I felt overwhelmed with that, I wanted to do something more with my hands. And I had all these kind of meandering paths to allow me to be more tangible. My first was botanical illustration, and I went back to programming, and then I started developing RSI, carpal tunnel, and I do have this tendency to want to learn something and go all into it. And,
as you said before.
as I said before, and my friend suggested that I get a massage, and I said, oh, I got a massage, and it actually helped me, and I said, why not just learn how to do this myself? So I took 1,000 hours of massage therapy and learned everything about the body. But then went back to programming because I always have this draw to create through that medium, and did the same thing with sewing and denim specifically, because I just love denim because it takes on the wear of someone's life. But eventually went back to programming.
By the way, my husband has this motto, nihil in moderado, which is nothing in moderation. You should like tattoo that on your other arm.
Or everything in moderation.
Perhaps.
Nothing is everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, co-founder of Twitter and the financial services company Square. We'll hear more from Jack coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the internet entrepreneur Jack Dorsey. He's the founder of Twitter, the social media company that allows users to send messages using no more than 140 characters. He's also the founder of the mobile payments company Square. Other names considered for Square were seashells, an early currency people used to exchange goods, and squirrel, the idea being that people gather funds from others in the same way that squirrels gather acorns. In 2005, you got a more traditional job at a company called Odeo, which was a podcast directory company, which ultimately didn't do well because iTunes came out with their service. And through this turmoil, you developed Twitter, although the seeds for Twitter were kind of in your back pocket in 2000 when you initially had the idea for something that became Twitter. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what that germ was in 2000? Briefly?
Well, leading from dispatch, you know, I had this beautiful picture of the city, but I was missing the people. And I was a big fan of instant messenger as well, with especially around statuses. So I'm on a call, I'm in a meeting, I'm listening to this particular song. So the idea was to be able to take something small like that and to take it anywhere. And I had the first BlackBerry device, the RIM 850. And I coded up I programmed a little service that took an email from that device, and it would send it out to all my friends. And I was living in San Francisco at the time. I went to Golden Gate Park. There's a bison paddock with bison roaming around in Golden Gate Park in the middle of the city. And I went there and I said, I'm at the bison paddock in Golden Gate Park. And it was sent out to all my friends via email. And I quickly learned that, number one, no one cared, and number two, No one else had a BlackBerry device. It was an interesting idea, but it was ahead of its time a bit, and the technology just was not there.
The technology wasn't there until 2006.
So, in 2006, sure enough, I was introduced to SMS at Odeo, and SMS short messaging service, text messages, was just a beautiful technology. I fell in love with it. It had this great constraint of 160 characters. It worked on every single phone out there. The idea came back up. What if we just took text messaging and we enabled anyone to text a service, and then it would go out to all the people that cared about it?
You mentioned that you like the constraint of 160 characters of texting. You've always seemed to have an appreciation for minimalism. Growing up, your mom said that when you moved into your new home, you chose the smallest room, and you had two younger brothers.
I don't like having a lot of stuff. I don't like carrying around a lot. I like a lot of simplicity, and really just comes down to not having to carry much in the world. So I'm a person who, you know, when I find a watch, it's going to be the watch for the rest of my life. And when I find a bag, you know, I'll keep it for 15, 20 years.
Now, was your love of these 160 characters, you think, consistent with your minimalism? Or why did you love the 160?
I love the 160 because I do like constraint. If I give you a paintbrush and I tell you to go paint this huge canvas I have on the wall, it's somewhat intimidating and you're going to be very thoughtful and composed about it. If I give you that same paintbrush and I give you the back of a business card and tell you to make a mark, you'll make a mark. So there's something interesting about making the canvas size small and making it more approachable. And then it becomes more of the moment, becomes more expressive, and every mark, therefore, is beautiful and useful to someone. I was not someone who really enjoyed blogging because the format was just too long and unconstrained, whereas with 160 characters, which we then pulled down to 140 characters, there was a nice constraint, and I could be more of the moment, and there was more creativity because I had to fit it all in.
Why did you then pick 140 characters for Twitter? Was that arbitrary?
Well, there are two reasons. The 160 was purely practical in the sense that we wanted to work on every device out there. So a $5 cell phone in the middle of Kenya could also receive a message from anywhere in the world. And also that constraint inspires creativity concept. So we took 20 characters out for a username and for some syntax, and we arrived at 140 characters.
And Twitter, the name, the definition is inconsequential bursts of information.
Yes, and chirps from birds.
Right. Yeah. And some other names you flirted with, Jitter and Twitch.
Twitch.
Right.
They don't bring up the best imagery.
Mm. So at the time, you were working with Ev Williams and Biz Stone, who had worked at a company called Blogger, sold to Google. And you were made CEO. And prior to that, you were a contractor for mm-hmm. them. Why did they think that you should be CEO? You were very young. You had no leadership experience. By the way, I should mention Noah Glass was involved
yes.
as well.
So Noah was the co-founder of Odeo, and Ev was the CEO. And as soon as iTunes launched the directory, the company became directionless. So brought up the idea for Twitter, and we built it in 2 weeks. And the first tweet was actually inviting coworkers, which were inviting my coworkers from Odeo to join me. And you know, the reason that I became CEO is because I was leading the product and I was leading the direction, and it made sense. And we had about 7 people at that time.
And how are you feeling at the time? You know, you were programming, but you were also managing. Were you like, okay, like I'm owning this, I'm good at it?
It wasn't really something that I thought about. I thought about just building the product. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that you had to manage necessarily. I actually think managing is somewhat of a reactive word. It's something like I have to manage the situation versus coach
editing.
Or build.
Or editing.
Editing is another good one. So very particular about the words that we use in the companies, and I think that sets the tone for everything.
What were your ambitions for Twitter? How much of an impact did you think it would have?
Well, it's fairly selfish. I wanted to go back to that idea of maps, and I wanted to see the world. I wanted to see how the world was feeling. I wanted to see what it was doing.
Were you surprised when President Obama adopted it for his town halls and the Iranian protesters used it to the extent that the U.S. State Department asked you to keep the service running when you were going to do a maintenance, and Rupert Murdoch's using it? Talk to me about your level of surprise or...
Well, every day there's a new surprise and something that we find really, really delightful about how people are using it. So people tweet by tweet change how they think about it and how the world thinks about the service. And that, to me, shows something that's going to last, because it's like electricity. It's something that we don't really think about unless we're talking about it, unless it goes down. Otherwise, we plug in a microwave oven, we plug in an electric guitar, a keyboard, a seat warmer, whatever. But it's always there. It's always useful. And we can have all these different experiences based on how we perceive it and based on how we use it.
Ev Williams asked you to leave as CEO. Was that a surprise to you, or what was your reaction?
Well, we switched roles. So Ev really wanted to be CEO, and he was our chairman, and I became chairman, and he became CEO. So it was a different, certainly different perspective. It was surprising and also freeing at the same time.
You seem very measured and unflappable, but is that really, like, I'd love to just dig into your emotional state. Was it like, okay, well, that's disappointing, but blessing?
No, it was a hard departure. You know, it was something that I loved, that I'd been thinking about since I was a kid, and to not be as directly involved was certainly extremely, extremely challenging and devastating for me for quite some time. But you have to get over it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jack Dorsey, the co-founder of the social networking company Twitter, and Square, a mobile payments company that, among other attributes, offers a micro-merchant payment acceptance service that allows any business owner to accept payments from customers. Merchants are charged a flat 2.75% for each transaction, which is lower than the typical fee that payment processors have historically charged. The company offers Square Register, which turns mobile devices into a point-of-sale system, providing inventory management, customer tracking, and other business analytics. Square Wallet allows customers to buy products, such as Starbucks coffee, without having to use their actual credit card. You founded Square with a partner, Jim McKelvey, who is a glassblower, and he was your first boss in Missouri. You worked for him as one of your odd jobs, helping him with his back office maintenance, essentially. Yeah. How did you and Jim come to the idea of Square?
Jim is a glassblower. He kind of departed engineering. He was building companies before, and that's a company I work for. And he really got into glassblowing, and he was doing it, and he was selling these glass faucets for and pieces of glass, and he would sell them for $2,000 a piece. And one day someone called him up and wanted to buy one, but he couldn't accept a credit card. He couldn't accept an Amex card. And he lost a sale because of it. 90% of this country, at least, is paying with plastic, debit cards, credit cards, prepaid cards. So if you don't accept plastic, you miss out on sales. People go elsewhere. So we just found it funny that one could not just download an app today and start accepting credit cards. And we decided to take a month and to figure out if we could build a system around it.
Now, you had been noodling on other ideas prior to choosing to move forward with Square. One other idea he had was to build an electric car company.
Yes, we were looking at everything. I actually wasn't looking at finance much at all, because I really have no basis for it. I don't understand it.
You launched at an auspicious time, ironically. It was in 2008, at the time of the crash. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, there were a lot of auspicious pointers to what we were doing. First, I was living across the street from the U.S. Mint in San Francisco.
Coincidentally.
Which is a very auspicious location to start a payments company, and it's purely coincidence. There's no better time to create something than in a depression or a recession, because people are resetting. They're a little bit more willing to take a look at new things.
Although, venture capitalists might not feel like it's a very favorable time. People are, keeping their wallets close. You know, people thought, oh, you're the Twitter guy. You know, this is random to do financial services. What do you think convinced them?
Showing them the product. So, the best thing was we built this system in a month and we could start accepting credit cards. And they said, wow. So, I did approach a lot of VCs and investors with this idea, and they did push back. You worked on quote unquote microblogging. You worked on something that people used to talk about what they had for breakfast. Why do you think you can move billions of dollars around in a financial market.
What role did the Golden Gate Bridge have in just, you know, being wallpaper, to helping to influence your motivation, if any?
Absolutely. We live in a very fortunate area in San Francisco, and we look to the Golden Gate Bridge all the time because it's not just the end product that is gorgeous and amazing and iconic. And a wonder, but also the way they built it. They built it in 1934. They gave themselves 5 years. They built it in 3 years. Only 1,300 people worked on the bridge. They did it with $33 million, which is about $1.2 billion in today's money. Mm. So epic scale. And it's a 1.7-mile span across one of the most tumultuous areas on the West Coast. And then there's earthquakes. It's the last place on the planet that you want to build a bridge. So, you know, at its very core, a bridge is utility. It gets people from point A to point B. And at its very core, Square and Twitter is a utility. It gets either communication from point A to point B or money from point A to point B. And they have a lot of parallels. And if it does that well, it disappears. But if people really notice it, it's something that is breathtaking and they appreciate it. So we want to build something that is similar to that idea.
Along those lines, the Square's card reader was inducted into the Museum of Modern Art's archive in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Skeuomorphism?
Yes.
What is that?
Skeuomorphism is a practice in design to through digital interfaces to refer to real interfaces. I think there's a great balance of referencing something that we know as we go into something new, which is digital, and that's what we're trying to do at Square. A lot of our products reference real objects because it establishes trust. It's an opening. With Square Register, the thing actually looks like a paper pad and. We have a page turn as you're ripping off a ticket. Square Wallet, there's references to cards. There's references to leather. Just hints at them. But that's really all it takes.
And they hint at them so that people don't feel as intimidated to try them and to adopt them.
Yeah, there's a warmth to things we know and to things we're used to.
I want to go back to the early days of Square. You saw a hole in the financial service market where micro merchants or small businesses weren't able to accept credit cards because the payments to credit card companies were just too onerous. What was Amex and MasterCard and Visa's response to your entering?
So there's 8 million entities, 8 million businesses that accept credit cards in the United States alone, but there's over 26 million small businesses who don't. So they saw it as a way to extend their network. At the end of the day, what they care about the most is removing cash and moving more to electronic payments. So they saw Square as a way to really advance that agenda.
Your first few merchants were Sightglass, which is this coffee shop in San Francisco you're an investor in, mm-hmm. as well as a florist. Mm-hmm. Who else were some of the earliest?
We had, Sightglass, which was just a coffee cart, a flower cart named Lilybell. And a flight instructor, actually, and that was it.
Starbucks was your first larger business, which has opened up a completely new array of partners for you. How did that happen? Did Howard Schultz approach you, or did you approach them? What's the story there?
Howard and Starbucks actually approached us, and they said, you know, we've been looking at a lot of payment companies, and we've been looking at really moving ahead in terms of how we're thinking about mobile payments specifically. We would love for you to come up to Seattle and tell us about Square. So we went up there, and we just had a great meeting.
You, in less than a year, built the hardware and the payment network and the risk systems and the customer service and the web services, and you coordinated all these systems all from scratch, basically.
Mm-hmm. All from scratch. We built Square and made it operational in under 9 months. And then Starbucks was very similar.
So what are some hiccups that you've had in the early days? Because it seems like things have been pretty seamless.
Some of the hiccups that we saw was, you know, it took us a lot longer than normal to actually get the credit card processing infrastructure out. We had to go through a lot of regulation. So we first launched Square as a cash-only register. And people knew about Square before that, and the promise was you could accept credit cards anywhere. So the people that were really cheering for us said, you know, what's going on? And it took us another 5 months to actually roll out the credit card processing.
What about, because you're trying to do so much, you know, there's obviously a lot of competitors who are going to be innovating, and probably conventionally people might say, well, why don't you just focus on one aspect of this payment process instead of trying to build the entire system? What is your response to that?
Well, we do see it as a focus, but we see it as a different focus. Going back to the Golden Gate Bridge, if we want to build something truly magical, we have to build that entire span, right? It has to be end-to-end. So a lot of our competitors are building a credit card terminal or a point of sale or a cash register or a payment network or a bank or coupons, whatnot. And they're all disconnected. They're all separate companies and they're all separate systems. And when you try to when a merchant or a buyer, a customer tries to put all these together, they don't really fit together. They're not seamless. And you start noticing the seam points. So our focus is building that entire span. Mm-hmm. And there's still a simplicity around that.
Might you be a tender type one day and replace a MasterCard or a Visa?
Well, that's not what we're optimizing for. There's certainly a potential or a reality for that, but our idea has always been we're always going to accept the payment device, the tender that comes over the counter, because that means the merchant is always getting the sale.
So going from, you know, these financial complexities to your mom, does she use Square?
She does. Just yesterday, I sent my mom a gift card from here in New York to her favorite bookstore, Left Bank Books, in the Central West End. And I sent my father a week of cappuccinos to his favorite coffee company, Sump Coffee, in the city.
And I've heard that you text or maybe tweet with your mom daily. What was the last mundane communication you had with her?
No, my mom is usually the first person that texts me in the morning, the last person that texts me every day. They just moved to a new condo that's right on the Mississippi River, so she usually sends me pictures of the sunrise or the sunset.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jack Dorsey. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and then to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding, you know, what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
You see, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away. He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah. So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her, and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top-performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly, and it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off, and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom, and then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey. Mm-hmm.
So
then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
in Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, you know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Hmm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle. And she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know, So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money, and you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were sort of the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, like about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18 running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy.
If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.